From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As we charge toward the midterm election, political candidates around the country are pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into TV advertising. Much of it, as always, horrifying to behold. We checked in with Mark Halperin, political director of ABC News, for a preview of how his network will be handling election night. He's also been following the campaign ads and has a couple of abominations to share, starting with a spot produced for incumbent Senator Max Baucus of Montana.
It's an ad produced by the Democratic Committee in Washington. Both major parties have campaign arms in Washington that work on Senate and House races, and they tend to be the ones who are sort of the henchmen expected to do more of the dirty work. This ad in Montana was done on behalf of the incumbent Democratic Senator Max Baucus, attacking his opponent, a state legislator named Mike Taylor, who'd worked many years ago as a hairdresser and as the owner of beauty parlors around the state of Montana and elsewhere. He had done a television show in which he'd sort of demonstrated the techniques of his trade, and the ad itself showed Mr. Taylor in a mod garb from a bygone era working on the face and hair of a gentleman sitting in a barber's chair. And the Taylor campaign felt the ad suggested that he was gay. It was such a devastating effect on him that Mr. Taylor, who was pretty far behind before the ad went on the air, suspended his campaign for a time and said he simply couldn't campaign under the cloud he felt of that ad caused.
Now, the clothing these men were wearing was a sin against God and man. It was the 70s, but never can I remember the issue of someone's sexuality in a race for the United States Senate being an issue, however obliquely it may have been suggested.
Well, of course, the beauty of the ad from the point of view of just being a professional political strategist is the ad never said Mike Taylor was gay. It showed him in what you call hideous clothes, I call vintage clothing. It just showed him touching this man's face, rubbing lotion on him, and the Democrats in their sort of faux innocent way said, well, we weren't raising that question. We were just trying to make this point, and this was the video we had to use.
Yeah, although they had many hours of video available to them that showed Taylor doing the hair of women.
I didn't say I believe them. I just said that's what they said.
Okay. Now, there's another in the race for the Texas governorship.
Very strong advertising throughout that campaign. The Texas Democratic candidate, Tony Sanchez, is a multimillionaire, and he has been pounding the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, with just negative ad after negative ad on all sorts of things. Rick Perry has raised a decent amount of money to fight back, and one of the ads he ran linked Mr. Sanchez to the murder of a DEA agent many years ago based on a tie to Mr. Sanchez's banking empire. Very tough ad, very aggressive, very hard-hitting imagery, very emotional, but along the lines of what we've seen other places with the use of Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden, just a very emotional-laden imagery meant to paint a powerful picture, pack up a big wallop.
Let me move away from the advertising for a moment. You're ABC's political director, and that means you're the guy who says the race is over when, you know, less than 100% of the precincts have reported. 2 years ago, the networks got into huge trouble with exit poll data from the Voter News Service. Is ABC going to be more cautious this year about how it uses the VNS data?
We are. VNS has gone through a major revision, and they're trying to be ready for this election night. We've built a system, a beefed-up political unit system, to be able to tell people what's happening on election night with data that we're fully comfortable with from VNS and from other sources.
Now, there's this enormous pressure on election night for each network to try to beat the others in calling a race. Do you expect this countervailing pressure of the experience of the presidential election to keep the networks from jumping so quickly?
To some extent, outsiders overstate the level of competitiveness that the networks have had over the last few years. It was once very intense, but I think it had declined even before 2000 to call each and every individual race first. It was sort of an insider's game that I think had already started to decline. But there's no question that in 2002, on this election night, people are going to be at ABC News and elsewhere concerned with 100% accuracy.
But you're not going to wait for World News Tonight on Wednesday to talk about the results.
We might have to. It's simply a combination of very close races, very high stakes, the parties being more likely to be litigious. I think there's all sorts of reasons to think that we may have some of these key races go all the way through, maybe beyond World News the next night.
Finally, when we last spoke, we were talking about ABC News being ever vigilant for campaign tactics that may come in through mailers and other media. Have you gotten a flood of heads-ups from viewers around the country about ugly campaign maneuvers that are trying to slip in under the radar?
Not as much of a flood as we would have liked. We've gotten a pretty steady drizzle, but it's this last weekend and the day before Election Day and Election Day itself where these things are really going to be coming fast and furious, and we're hoping that people go on our website if they hear or see anything on the radio, television, internet, in their mailbox, on their telephone that suggests to them that it's either false or in some ways overly negative, and that we'll be able to track them down in time and explain to voters again the purpose and sponsor of those messages.
All right. Mark Halperin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Halperin is the political director for ABC News. To assist in their election watchdog efforts, email tips to politicalunit@abcnews.com.
If you'd picked up last Sunday's New York Times to find out how the peace protest in Washington went last Saturday, you would have read that, quote, fewer people attended than organizers had hoped for. Apparently, there wasn't much else to report. But had you come across the Times last Wednesday, you would have read that attendance was pegged at 100,000 and that organizers called it the biggest anti-war protest since the days of the Vietnam War. Also on Wednesday, this from NPR.
A correction now. On Saturday, October 26th, in a story on the protest in Washington, D.C. against a U.S. war with Iraq, we erroneously reported, on All Things Considered, that the size of the crowd was, and I quote, fewer than 10,000. While Park Service employees gave no official estimate, it is clear that the crowd was substantially larger than that. On Sunday, October 27th, we reported on Weekend Edition that protest organizers estimated the crowd at 100,000. We apologize for the error.
Greg Mitchell is the editor of Editor and Publisher. A survey in that magazine's upcoming issue of how the major newspapers covered the protest revealed a surprising lack of consensus. While the L.A. Times buried the story on page A17 of their Sunday edition, the hometown paper, the Washington Post, had the story on its cover.
The shocking thing is that of the major papers, the New York Times was the only one that went with a much, much lower number. Other papers seem to have gotten the number right. One of the biggest surprises in the reporting that we've done is the editor for the Boston Globe, another so-called liberal paper, which did give wide play to the protest. This editor now says that maybe the Globe went too far and that if another march came up of the same size on the same topic, they might give less coverage next time.
Do you suspect that this editor at the Globe was trying to overcompensate, perhaps, for a perceived liberal bias?
It's a funny thing where the liberal papers seem to be taking the protest with a grain of salt, perhaps, and the more moderate papers are seeing it as perhaps more significant. What's interesting is that the two outlets that have been accused of most missing the demonstration were the New York Times and NPR. And these, of course, are two of the media giants that are often accused, rightly or wrongly, of being overly liberal. The only explanation, if you were going to take a political line on this, would be that they were compensating for what they've seen as their too sympathetic coverage for the anti-Iraq forces in the past. But it's hard for me to believe that that would be the main motivation of really missing this story so badly.
These crowd estimates are incredibly political numbers, though, aren't they?
Yeah, well, you know, probably from the beginning of media time, protesters have always had at least one eye, if not both eyes, on the media. Sometimes the actions are taken mainly to get media coverage or to get media to take them seriously. And so it's not surprising that the question of turnout and how a march is covered becomes so important. I think that, what has happened is that the wild variety of coverage and miscoverage of the latest demonstration, I think, is an outgrowth of the media in general not taking the wide anti-war protests, which have included referendums and local petitions and things like that, have not really taken it seriously. And so they were taken by surprise by the size of this demonstration.
In an article on the Editor and Publisher website this week, you called the Wednesday Times story a, quote, makeup article, unquote. Does the original reportage or the subsequent makeup suggest anything about a paper's editorial policy, or is it merely a correction?
I don't think it was directed by their editorial stance. More likely it was a slip-up in their Washington bureau, and they then received tremendous numbers of emails and phone calls blasting them for their coverage, which they've admitted to us. And in facts that we received from the New York Times, they noted that they had received a lot of commentary from outside, and they decided to look at it again.
You don't buy the idea that many of the protesters have presented in their organized email campaign against the inaccurate reporting that the media is actually biased against the anti-war movement? You think this was just a screw-up?
Well, if you're referring to the case of the New York Times, I think it's more likely a screw-up, that whether it was the reporter didn't even really make it to the rally, whether the reporter didn't stay around for when the hundreds of buses pulled in and tens of thousands of people joined the march. Maybe the editors edited some of the commentary out. I don't know. Now, whether there is a national media bias against anti-war types and protesters in general, I think that that's probably true in the sense that there has been very, very little coverage of their activities, so that this demonstration really hit like a thunderclap.
Do you think that the organized protest against the coverage by the anti-war groups that staged the demonstration has had the effect of actually garnering more interest and more media awareness for their cause?
What's changed drastically in the last decade is the way that you can lodge your protest via email. You can literally, and I'm sure this happened with many of the marchers this past weekend, they marched in the afternoon and then they went home and emailed in the evening or the next day protesting coverage. I think some media outlets dismiss organized protests. They say it's not coming from the heart. They're just whipped up into doing it. But as we see in this case and in many other cases now, it does have an effect, and it does call newspapers' attention to maybe something that they messed up on, and then they come back and try to get it right. So this, in a way, is kind of a watershed event in terms of the media coverage, because now this signals that this is at least something to be taken seriously. Whether the media gives it wide play or not, you know, we don't know, but at least now it's sort of entered the national arena.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Greg Mitchell is the editor of Editor and Publisher, and will be publishing in the November 4th issue a piece on the coverage of the anti-war protests last Sunday.
Up next, how fake quotes from fake people piled up at the AP, and why the body count is mounting on primetime television.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Back with On the Media, I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Recently, a Washington-based reporter for the Associated Press was charged with fabricating quotes, sources, and sometimes entire organizations in dozens of stories. Mostly they were invented quotes like, "This is not an exact science," or "It's a two birds with one stone situation," or "War changes people," or some variety of the ever-popular "Time will tell." The quotes changed nothing. They didn't slant the stories. In fact, they seemed to create almost perfect balance. The reporter, Christopher Newton, was summarily fired. And this week in Slate.com, Jack Schaefer decreed, quote, that if Newton violated the journalist's credo to tell the truth, we should strip him naked, drag him into the Chihuahuan desert, smear him with honey, and feed him to the fire ants. But Schaefer also muses that among all his crimes, was Newton's greatest offense one of banality?
I think the reason that he wasn't caught is that when the reader encounters what is the equivalent of a string of zeros on his page, That is, when someone gives the canned, stock, obvious response from an opposing view, the mind just naturally deletes it, ignores it, doesn't concentrate on it. If any of these invented sources had said something insightful, provocative, and truly quotable, I think it would have been found out a lot sooner. I think that this speaks to the sort of vulnerable part of the standard news story formula, where every news event requires then for the journalist to go collect an opposing view. I think it reveals the weakness of the AP formula, that for 32 months, this guy invented sources, inserted them into news stories, and nobody was any the wiser.
So what do you propose? You're not proposing that we toss out the opposing views, are you?
If you know that there is an opposing view, why not let the reporter express it concisely? I think in every one of his stories, he could have made a better and certainly a more accurate story just by saying some interest groups oppose this point of view.
But instead, he made up quotes and organizations to say the same exact boilerplate that he would have gotten from the actual organizations. Why do you think he bothered?
It could be that he was incredibly harried and over his head and didn't have the, 2.5 minutes for each story that it would take to locate an academic specialist or somebody at a think tank to give the opposing view. Or he may have been some sort of quiet rebel expressing his disdain for the formula that requires the journalist to make a phone call and find a quotation to state the obvious. I mean, one of the things that the news shouldn't be is a statement and a restatement of the obvious. Anybody who's ever been on the receiving end of a phone call from a journalist looking for an opinion sometimes feels like they're being groped by a casting director. The journalist will call you up and say, "So would you say that?" And then they'll give you some sort of quote, and you shake it off like a pitcher who doesn't want to throw the catcher's pitch. And they say, "Well, would you say that?" And then they'll give you another opportunity. And they'll ask the question 5 different ways, and you can see quite clearly coming at you is that they have an idea of how to fill the module in their story. And they're going to phone around until they find a person with the proper title and background to create this illusion of balance.
Let's talk about the role of the AP in American journalistic life. It's sort of the base from which everything else seems to spring, at least in a lot of places.
Well, the AP is indispensable. According to its website, it transmits 20 million words of copy a day. It's this huge drift net, and if you like the metaphor of a fishing trawler, I welcome you to it, gathering news, processing it, in many cases freeze-drying it, and sending it out to its thousands upon thousands of subscribers. So the AP is sort of the basic news. If journalism is the first draft of history, then the AP is the first draft of journalism in many cases.
If the AP is the first draft of the first draft, what does the alleged crime of Christopher Newton say about journalism in general?
I think that the sad truth is that there are probably many Christopher Newtons out there cutting corners, inventing sources. At Slate, we were embarrassed and shocked and are still wearing the hair shirt over a man who wrote a story about a monkey fishing episode. He really did go monkey fishing off the coast of Florida, but he created all these exciting details to embellish his story and make it sexier.
But that's exactly the point. There are people who make things up in order to make their stories more exciting. There are people who make things up in order to bolster their argument. They come up with bogus facts or bogus studies. There are people who make things up in order to misrepresent the situation. This guy made things up in order to make things seem more true.
He devoted himself to producing the most banal and flat quotations he possibly could. It's very hard to say nothing. And he said nothing, in 40 different news stories with invented sources. You know, one of the things that I've learned as an editor over the last 20 years, it's incredibly difficult to beat an accomplished liar. And I think in Christopher Newton's case, if it is true that these people don't exist and he hasn't brought them forward, he was an exceptional liar.
Jack Schaefer, thank you very much.
Anytime, baby.
Jack Schaefer is editor-at-large for Slate.com.
You have watched the scene 1,000 times. A cop visiting the morgue, the corpus delicti laid out on a slab, mostly out of view. All we see is a pair of undraped dead feet, an ID tag dangling from the big toe. Because the dead body in its entirety is too graphic, too ghoulish. Or anyway, it used to be. Nowadays, an evening of prime time is a voyage to cadaver world. There are the police dramas like Law and Order, the HBO hit series 6 Feet Under, about a family-run mortuary, and NBC's Crossing Jordan, not to mention the top-rated forensic drama, CSI, getting grittier by the season.
COD?
Laryngeal spasm. We usually see this in drownings, only instead of swallowing water, he swallowed fire.
Causes the larynx to pinch shut, protecting itself, yet cutting off his air supply. And that leads to immediate unconsciousness and death. Another example of the body trying to protect itself, and I'd say in this case it didn't work.
Paul Fari of The Washington Post wrote recently about TV's lively trade in dead bodies. He joins me now. Paul, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Now, there was a time when Lucy Ricardo couldn't mention the word pregnant, and there was a time when corpses were strictly under the sheets. What in the world has happened?
Well, not only were they under the sheets, but they were up under the sheets until just a very few years ago. Now, this stuff is pretty gruesome. I have to say that the gruesomeness kind of started with shows like ER back in the early 90s, where you'd see the arteries spurting like a geyser, or you'd see someone with an open chest wound. But again, those were living people. I don't know if that makes it any different, but nevertheless, we never quite got to the state where CSI now shows the autopsy with the victim's chest opened up in a butterfly fashion with the organs laid out on the slab next to it. I'm not sure we can go much further than that.
In the old days, when you saw a dead body, it never really looked like any dead body I've ever seen. But, you know, you watch television today and you look at these images and it's like, whoa, that lady looks dead.
We have lots of new tools that television producers can now use that used to be reserved just for the movie guys with the bigger budgets. On Boomtown, there was a murder scene in which the corpse was inside a footlocker and is fished out of the ocean and then tumbles onto the back of the yacht. And you see this blue, horrifyingly decayed body tumbling out of the footlocker. And that was done with tinting the film after the fact.
There have been many complaints over the years from the Vietnam War on, and then increasingly when drug violence overran the inner cities, that the images of death in TV news were desensitizing the culture and making young people especially lose any sense of real life and death stakes. It all looked like a movie. Now that it is entertainment programming and all this grisly fare, do we have reason to fear for how it's affecting the culture in the years to come?
I think there's something very interesting here, which is as the entertainment industry gets more gruesome, the news media actually becomes less and less gruesome. Every single day, somewhere in the world, there is footage of some dead person, some horrific thing going on. And it's, I don't want to say it's censored, that's ridiculous, but they really do sanitize the news to the extent that it's easy to show bleeding bodies lying on the street, but they don't because it's revolting and it's really not the last thing you want to see before you go to bed at night.
So on the entertainment side, where does it end? I mean, how much more graphic can the images be and how much can the audience tolerate?
I think that's up to the kind of imagination, sick as it may be, of the creators of these shows. Like all things, though, the public wearies of the same old thing, and perhaps we'll go back to just good old-fashioned violence with the victim living.
How about to no violence at all?
That's not going to happen. I think we like our violence in America, and there will always be something on TV that's violent or at least give a strong suggestion of it. And that's one point that we should make here. Very often, these shows are not per se violent. They won't show you how the victim became the victim, but they will show you the aftermath of it. The question is that somehow more socially responsible to show you the consequence of violence than the violence itself.
Okay, that's the question. What's the answer?
Hell if I know.
Okay, well, Paul Fahrie, thank you very much. It's a pleasure as always.
Thanks, Bob.
Paul Fahrie is a reporter with the Style section of The Washington Post.
For the past dozen years or so, American television viewers have been mesmerized by reality TV, from Survivor to Jerry Springer to Cops. These shows tend to feature real people behaving at their worst.
North Carolina, 1994. Officers find themselves against an enraged man with a shotgun.
I don't get the damn hell away here.
It's a delicate matter, but one the police are equipped to handle.
The show is called World's Wildest Police Videos. The image is a shotgun-wielding man, shirtless on his porch, raving at police. He has gotten himself stinking blotto. He has done violence in his household. Now he is making terrorist threats and a total jackass of himself for all his neighbors and a few million others to see. Renee Less can scarcely believe her good fortune.
He's just this big, fat guy on his porch raving with an enormous gun, and they're all shirtless. None of them are wearing shirts.
She is lucky because in addition to having no shirts, the shotgun-wielding porch stander honors of this nation also have no shame. This man signed a release permitting World's Wildest Police Videos to broadcast his image, and the owner of most every other unobscured face you see on these gritty police reality shows has done the same thing. Lesk is in charge of obtaining these releases. She is awash in 8x11 forms, ready to be stuffed into dozens and dozens of thick vinyl binders.
There's an alternate paper universe that agrees with the visual universe that you look at every day.
But why? Why let some TV producer trade in your personal humiliation? Fred Heilbrunn, a permissions specialist who has obtained nearly 10,000 releases for such shows as True Stories of the Highway Patrol, offers a number of explanations, from malignant macho to civic-mindedness to, every so often, cash money. But it is still hard for him to believe how easy it is. Once, he says, he was with a camera crew at a heroin bust, and one of the suspects bolted directly toward them.
The cameraman, who was built like a halfback, steps out. The suspect falls backward into a wall, and the cameraman sticks the camera in this fella's face. And then the cameraman follows it up by saying, "Don't move or I'll shoot you." And the fella threw his hands up in the air and complied like the cameraman had an MP5 pointed at the guy's head. It was just amazing.
Did you approach him to sign a release?
Oh, yeah. And he signed.
To Renee Lesk, the "stop or I'll shoot" gambit suggests another possibility for suspects' willingness to sign on the dotted line: the confusion over who is a cop and who isn't, and maybe the hope that cooperation with the camera crew will yield softer treatment from the police down the line. Fred Heilbrunn says cultivating that confusion is unethical, and often enough, he says, an opposite force may be at work.
They found out that when the police come through your door, you know, knock it off its hinges, come barreling through, throw you into the wall, handcuff you, and then somebody walks up and says, "Hi, my name's Fred. Has anybody told you what the cameras are about?" The people relaxed.
Bad cop, good producer.
Yeah. You know, I have to admit, I learned some of my techniques from watching the police work.
One thing that all release getters quickly learn is that the culture of reality television, and the culture in general, work in their favor. In this society, appearing on television is deemed an achievement in its own right, and neither the subjects nor the audience seem to be all that concerned about how that is achieved. You know, "Hey, Tony, I saw you on TV. Was that your shotgun? What happened to your shirt?"
I think my favorite was a fella who, to pay off a debt to a dealer, offered his barn to be set up as a meth lab. The way the police found out about him was his electric bill, which should have been perhaps $150 a month, was something like $10,000 a month, and he wasn't paying it.
As police raided the barn, the guy quickly grabbed a guitar and started singing.
When I told him what I wanted, he said, "Will you show me singing?" And I said, "If you'd like." And he signed the release.
No matter that he faced 20 years in prison.
He wanted to be sure that he was going to have at least 10 seconds of himself singing on a national television show, so we gave that to him.
How was the song?
It's terrible. Just terrible. I think, if I recall, he was doing like Puff the Magic Dragon, and it was just awful.
There's yet another category, the chastened criminal who wants to steer others away from foolish choices. Lesk's biggest coup was getting a release from a woman arrested for DWI who was taped for an hour making sexual advances on the arresting officer.
I can't help it, but I just know you're good looking. I appreciate it. Okay. I just don't know
if you feel it
from the ground
around. Outside
right there, okay? Outside.
That was, as they say, this lady's rock bottom, and she was persuaded that making herself a laughingstock on television was an appropriate way to begin her new life of sobriety. But of all the explanations for why Lesk's vinyl binders are so full, maybe the best is the most obvious.
Criminals are stupid.
And the best illustration is a piece of tape aired on her show for which no release was necessary because the suspect's face was not visible.
We saw a guy walk into a convenience store with a paper bag over his head. No holes. You know, he was obviously having some trouble seeing. And he tried to rob it, and it was so, he seemed so ineffectual because of the paper bag and the no holes, that the clerk didn't really understand that he was seriously trying to rob him, and he didn't have a weapon. So the clerk just said, I'm sorry, I don't understand you. And the guy with the bag on his head just walked away. Criminals are stupid. They're criminals because they're stupid. Their stupidity puts them in jail. Their stupidity keeps them in jail. When they get out of jail, their stupidity puts them back in jail. Criminals are stupid.
So what you're suggesting is, if I can read between the lines here, you're suggesting, and don't let me, please, put words in your mouth, that criminals are stupid.
That's what I'm saying.
As for the zeitgeist image of the shirtless ruffian on his porch raving, Lesk says, be not misled. There are no more of these people nowadays, she believes, than there ever were.
I think there are just more cameras. I got to tell you, I think the shirtless guy was raving at the police for our grandparents and our great-grandparents. But now there are cameras to capture it. They look for opportunities to capture it. Now we all see it, and the guy without the shirt doesn't mind. He wants his rants to be heard. He's perfectly happy with that development.
Oh, please release me. I don't love you anymore. To live.
Coming up, Peter Arnett on covering war in Iraq last time around, and a video game for the few and the proud.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your letters. On our interview with the producer of Journeys with George, a personal documentary by an NBC producer who followed the president on the campaign trail, Robert Saffer of Brooklyn had this to say, I'm wondering why you didn't bring up the obvious and to me troubling fact that no TV network would pick up the documentary until after the election. By showing it on election night, HBO guarantees that it can have no effect on this election cycle and minimizes any effect on the election 2 years hence.
After praising our usual performance as media watchdogs, Mark Wilbur of Oakland, California wrote to say that we were too easy on CNN chief of news gathering Eason Jordan when we asked what concessions he might have to make to maintain a presence in Baghdad. Wilbur writes, as you have reported yourselves, the major media already make significant concessions to getting the whole story. when they cooperate with the Pentagon and restrict themselves to official pools during U.S. military involvements. How can we possibly believe that they are not going to make concessions to despots who will even more eagerly deny them access for unfavorable coverage?
Sue Slade from Salt Lake City, Utah, enjoyed our piece on obituary writing at the New York Times. In it, we aired a clip from a 1989 interview with obit writer Peter Flint. Slade writes, "It was an eerie reminder of my cousin Peter's voice and laugh. He was an articulate and astute critic of theater and film, and he loved his job. A few years after that interview, Flint died, and Bob noted that we couldn't find an obituary. The fault was mine. My Nexus search technique was shoddy, and I thank the listeners who emailed the obituary that was indeed written for Mr. Flint."
Oh, Brooke, you didn't have to say that. Although, you know, the fault was yours. Please email your reactions, corrections, even obituaries to onthemedia@wnyc.org. But please, when you do, don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Eleven years ago, veteran war correspondent Peter Arnett fascinated and significantly infuriated America with his CNN coverage from Baghdad of the Persian Gulf War. As one of the few Western reporters on the ground in Iraq's capital, he was depended upon for much of our understanding of the war's effects. But because he broadcast only at the pleasure of Saddam Hussein's interior ministry flunkies, his censored reports were seen by many as de facto propaganda for the enemy. The most controversial was a tour of a bombed manufacturing plant described by the Iraqis as a baby milk factory, which, subsequent investigations suggest, it most probably was. Now Arnett is headed back to Baghdad to report for the news and documentary producer Camera Planet. We asked him if he is now more wary about being a tool of propaganda.
I would challenge the use of the term propaganda. If it's propaganda to say that, you know, near a military installation in Baghdad, there were 14 houses flattened, you know, by U.S. bombing, and that the Iraqis said there were 40 people dead, and you saw grieving relatives, and the water system was destroyed, and there was floods in the streets. That, to me, was just factual information. If, indeed, it reflected negatively on American bombing policy, I mean, that was really not an issue with me. Was I getting the facts was what I was concerned about.
Well, let's talk about the logistics of reporting from Baghdad while Allied forces are attacking. What is it like to deal with the Iraqi Ministry of Information?
The initial bombing of January 17, Baghdad time, when the boys of Baghdad, you know, Bernie Shaw, John Holloman, and I went on radio, in fact, you know, by telephone and reported the first 17 hours of the war, there was no intrusion by Iraqi officials.
Peter Arnett, join me here. Let's describe to our viewers what we're seeing. The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. We're seeing bright flashes going off all over the sky. Peter?
Well, there's anti-aircraft gunfire going into the sky. We hear the sound of planes. They're coming over our hotel. However, we have not yet heard the sound of bombs landing, but there's tremendous lightning in the sky, lightning like a fix. Bernie?
I have a sense, Peter, that people are shooting towards the sky, and they are not aware or cannot see what they're shooting at. This is extraordinary.
It was not until late in the day, I mean, getting near 17 hours on the air, that they actually came in and then told us that our broadcast had to end. So essentially, the first 17 hours of the war were not censored, and we were able to tell that very important initial, you know, bombing circumstance and the fact that, you know, that Baghdad was hit severely.
And then what happened?
The following day, after closing us down, the Iraqis told the few news people left in Baghdad that all our reports would be subject to prior censorship before they were on the air. And that meant presenting a script to a minder, to an official, and they would go over it, approve it, and let us broadcast it. So initially, it was very, very restricting. And I personally had doubts that, you know, I would really want to stay under those circumstances. What changed my mind was the fact that CNN had a 24-hour broadcast meant that I could sort of chat about minutiae to the anchors. And this casual conversation was accepted by the Iraqis as sort of just atmospheric, interesting commentary. So they said they would let me do my official 2 minutes. And then the anchor could come back at me and say, well, you know, that's all very well, Peter, but how are things at the hotel? And then I could talk on. And in the course of half an hour's conversation or so, you could really bring up lots of interesting minutiae. And we just kept that up during the whole course of the war.
Did you regard it as a trade-off that you were throwing the Iraqis the two-minute pre-approved, censored, and arguably propaganda-rich report in exchange for the opportunity to do the other hours of apparently casual reporting in which you could encode all sorts of context for the viewers to decode as they saw fit?
I didn't really see it as a trade-off. I mean, I'd worked under censorship on many previous occasions, like early days of the Vietnam War, at times in Israel when under certain circumstances that impose a degree of censorship. Certainly in the Soviet Union, while it was not direct censorship, they certainly were very controlling on the information they gave you access to.
Well, what about the stand-ups that you were talking about, the formal two-minute pieces that were approved by Iraqi censors? If you are in a facility that the Iraqis claim makes baby formula and the alliance forces have bombed it into oblivion, did you find yourself in the position of stating the Iraqis' claim absent the context that you as a reporter would like to have provided?
Well, that has been a fascinating example, and it's one of the most controversial stories I've done in my whole career, and it remains controversial. It's still cited as an example of Western media used as a propaganda vehicle for the Iraqis. We were called along to that building the day after it was struck. You know, we spent a couple of hours moving around there. I picked up baby milk powder from the floor. We photographed it. We picked up documents. I did the story. I did a couple more stories. There was a lot of controversy from the Bush administration about it actually being possibly a biological, testing plant. But in the later weeks, I mean, the Washington Post, the New York Times published tons of documents from the French company that had built it, from New Zealand and Australia that had sent milk powder over there to be processed. You know, I was there in 95 when it reopened and was producing baby milk powder. You know, from the beginning, the fact that I could move around that area, touch anything, look at anything, photograph anything, indicated to me there was not a security area. The Iraqis aren't stupid. The dozens of chemical and biological plants that were actually hit, we were never invited to visit those. You know, We were invited to visit the baby milk plant. So I think from the beginning, I could never understand why the U.S. just didn't say, look, we made a mistake. But they were incapable of doing it. And in fact, President George Bush has written two books. And in both of those books, he takes me to task for promoting Iraqi propaganda, and I just don't see that being valid.
And if I recall correctly, it seems to me that the anchors at CNN in Atlanta were periodically making the point that you were restricted in your coverage, didn't they?
Well, CNN went out of its way to basically distance itself from my reporting. On one hand, I mean, they were delighted that I could come up on a regular basis with my pictures and commentaries and reporting from the battlefield. On the other hand, you know, they labeled everything I did, you know, subject to Iraqi censorship. That was the label. There was no label put on any of the other reporting from any other side in the war other than on Peter Arnett's reports. The other aspect that CNN was very careful to do was to placate negative public attitudes to the reporting. There were many Americans felt that it was unpatriotic or traitorous to be on the other side. So, I mean, the burden was always on me to justify my being there. I remember John Holloman was anchoring one night out of Washington, and he said to me, Peter, isn't it true you're probably suffering from the Stockholm syndrome, which is, you know, the classic explanation of why prisoners identify with their captors? And I said, I am not suffering from the Stockholm syndrome. I'm reporting.
Peter Arnett, thank you very much.
Okay. Nice chatting with you.
Storied war correspondent Peter Arnett became famous in the first Gulf War, reporting for CNN. He is now preparing to return to Iraq as chief correspondent for the news and documentary producer Camera Planet.
The U.S. Army has spent more than $7 million developing its latest recruitment tool. A video game called America's Army is available for free online at GoArmy.com. On the Media asked a member of the Army's target audience to give it a try, 17-year-old Mark Delgado of Harlem, one of WNYC's radio rookies, came back from the front with this report.
I graduated high school 4 months ago, so right now I'm approaching a crossroads, and things could be a little foggy. I bet the Army would love to clear things up for me. I'm just not feeling the Army like that, but I'm willing to check out the game to see if it changes my mind.
This is about... Let's see.
But the Army wasn't making it easy for me.
It's loading up a little slow, brother. It's loading up a little slow. Don't worry about it.
I tried for a few hours to load the game on my computer and couldn't. So I called WNYC computer expert Greg Mattias. And he couldn't get it to load either. I was getting tight.
I want to play the game, man. How you go to gameplay, man? I don't like this.
Finally, after hours and hours of trying, we got the game to work.
Good morning, soldier, and welcome to the M16 qualification range. Today's task is to qualify with the M16A2 rifle. The conditions, you'll be given 40 targets. The standards, out of 40 targets, you must hit and engage 23 targets in order to qualify as a marksman.
In order to advance in America's Army, you have missions to complete as a soldier in training, and tests to pass which include your accuracy with a gun, speed through an obstacle course, and the dreaded airborne test, where you have to parachute from thousands of feet in the air into a target circle. Each qualification board was 5 minutes. I played that game for 3 hours trying to qualify, so you know what that means. I had to try over and over and over again.
Welcome back to another day of qualification.
So after many, many, many rounds, I got the hang of it and qualified.
Congratulations, soldier. You qualified as a marksman in the United States Army.
That's right, baby. That's right.
Then there was more qualification.
Make like a duck and waddle through that tunnel.
There was the obstacle course.
You just gave Hua a new meaning.
Infantry training and getting to know the burners. In my hood, that's what we call guns.
Today you will get to fire the M249 squad automatic weapon, the M203 40mm grenade launcher, and you will get to throw the M67 frag grenade and the M83 smoke grenade.
Sounds pretty hot, right? This is the hottest burner of them all.
This is the M249 SAW, a 5.56mm fully automatic weapon. Can be magazine or belt fed. Has a maximum effective range for a point target of 800 meters and a maximum effective range for an area target of 1,000 meters.
I got used to the guns after repeatedly using them. Since this is an internet-based game, I play with people from other states as part of my unit, and I shot at people from places like California, kind of like an East Coast-West Coast rivalry. I was having mad fun. Oh, but he shot me again. This game is hot. But it's just a game. I'm not all of a sudden motivated to join the Army. That's just me. So I asked my boy Dave if he thinks the video game is a smart move for recruiting.
Me personally, I will buy the game and disregard anything about recruiting. You feel me? Because the Army, that's not really, you know what I'm saying, where I'm at. That's not where my head is at. I mean, video games. You know what I'm saying? It gets a little gimmicky. And it's, I mean, the Army making a video game to recruit people, you know what I'm saying? That, nah, B, I just ain't feeling that.
Dave and I agree. Playing video games is playing video games. You leave it in the computer when you're tired of playing. But my other friend, Mike, feels the Army has the right idea.
Just like when you got a football game, you play the football game, then it gets you hyped. You want to go outside and play football. So I guess that will work the same way. They play like a Navy SEAL game or military game, and then they'll get them hyped, and they might like it like that, and then they might want to join.
Sergeant First Class Eric Vidal, a recruiting officer in Harlem, says the game is instilling the values of America's soldiers.
It's not just about killing, because during this game, if you have rules of engagements and rules of war. So if you go into a mission, your job is to complete the mission, with the least amount of force possible. I mean, you could wind up in jail. So, you know, you have those that go in there, and once they start firing up, they're going to find themselves penalized, and then they're going to have to start following the rules of engagement, the integrity, the values that we have in order to prosper during the game.
I don't know. If you give a teenager a video game with guns, he's going to shoot everything in sight. It's about busting shots to see if the guy looks real when he's dying. If you don't burst first, they're going to bust you and you're going to die. While I was talking to Sergeant Vidal, I had to ask about the part of the game that bugged me the most. The only part that I couldn't complete was the airborne.
Airborne.
The live jump. I didn't get it. I didn't know how to direct them to the circle. I just kept dropping.
The airborne, that's probably the best feature that we have right now. It's because it's so hard to dominate like the real life experiences. Like when you're coming off the tower in the airborne training, that is really the tower. And if you're ever in that situation and you do go to airborne training, you will see the trees just the way they are. You will see the tower just the way it is. I mean, they went to Fort Benning, Georgia. They shot the footage from all angles, and they try to keep it true to life.
That's what I'm scared of. It's so true to life. I died 15 times in the game just trying to qualify. How could that encourage anyone? It's a really good game, and I play a lot of them. I will play the game again without a doubt, but I was definitely not convinced to join the Army. And I have to say, if enlisting in the U.S. Army is as hard as downloading and installing the game America's Army, then the military's got some serious problems. For On the Media, I'm Mark Delgado III.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Megan Ryan, engineered by Dylan Keefe and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Marion McCune and Natasha Kurgunker. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.